From KQED Public Radio, this is Capitol Notes, our weekly podcast of politics and public policy here from our lovely studios at the State Capitol. Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, here in the studio with me. I'm John Myers from KQED, and this is the last podcast of February.
Oh, you tease.
That was about the only thing that I had planned coming in the studio was to be kind of funny on that.
How long did that one take you?
A couple of hours.
Still recovering from the budget, I see.
Right, exactly. It's the budget. It's not just the way I think. It's budget fatigue. So, yes, we are here at the last of February and the budget put to bed, finally, which, as Anthony said before we started this, that's you shouldn't do that when people are listening to a podcast. It really makes them want to
join in. Well, we put the budget to bed.
Well, it was good, yeah.
Visions of sugar plums.
What I was going to say is that Anthony, before we started the podcast, said, what are we going to talk about now that the budget deal's done? Because we've really been talking about budget shenanigans for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Well, but it's not over. There's a campaign.
And therefore, that's what we're talking about today. That's a long wind-up, folks. So now we get to start the fun and excitement of taking this to the people. So six ballot measures on the May 19th ballot in relation to the budget. There's a seventh one, which is not part of the budget deal, but that's confusing for people like me. Propositions 1A through 1F.
Yes.
Which maybe we'll start referring to in military code language, like Alpha. Bravo. Can you do the rest of them?
Charlie.
Delta. Echo.
Foxtrot. Right.
You just don't know.
Yankee Hotel.
No. We don't need that many ballot measures. Zulu. And Prop 13, which I think, interestingly enough, is actually about a property tax issue, so maybe appropriately is Prop 13.
Perhaps.
We'll set that one to the side, because let's just not load up the podcast listeners.
Where's
more
your
than
sound
that.
Effects board? You need like a compress a button and it will go whoosh.
This is public radio, not morning radio. It's not the morning zoo with Anthony and John. So let's get back to the subject. Holy moly. 1A through 1F. A spending cap. This is the short version, but I think actually what they're called and how they're defined is part of what is fascinating about this, because the legislature got to craft the title and the summary and make it exactly like it'll appear on the ballot, which doesn't happen when initiatives happen. The Attorney General does that vetting. So 1A is a spending cap. This is the short version. 1B is the Prop 98 money, the extra $9 billion or an additional $9 billion, which the schools may or may not have gotten. That's another issue. 1C is the lottery borrowing. Now I'm really going to get myself in trouble if I can't keep them in order.
I wasn't listening to what you said. 1A was the spending cap. B was the education.
C is the lottery. D is the... D is the Prop 10 transfer money, the tobacco tax money.
Prop F is the
1E.
Primary.
Hang on. You got ahead. 1E is the mental health Prop 63 shift. And 1F is the legislative salaries in times of deficits.
Oh, right. Open primaries 2010.
Yeah, that's a different whole thing. You got to drink a little more of that caffeine here and stay up with the podcast.
Wow.
So the campaign begins. What are we going to watch here? What do we make of this?
Well, you know what was interesting to me is what will be on the ballot arguments, which have already been turned in.
Right.
Since the election will be May 19th, sports fans, get ready. Only 60 shopping days left.
80 some, but anyway, who's counting?
Well. You know, what's interesting is the spending cap, which has sort of been the focus of a lot of this, was the big Republican get in these budget negotiations, right? This was the provision that was going to lead organized labor to recall Democrats. They supported a deal that included this cap on general fund spending. And now it seems like the strongest opposition is coming, the most outspoken opposition is coming from the right.
Now, do you think that is because what have you heard? Is that because of the cap itself or the taxes? And for people who don't really know how the cap works, and I'm not going to get into a long discussion, but long story short, It effectively sets a new limit on how much the state can spend every year. The limit is based on a rolling 10-year average of the years before of revenues. Money above that goes into a special little rainy day fund, which we won't get into how that works. But do you think it's the cap itself or the fact that there's a tax increase in this deal that's attached somehow to the cap?
I think it's the taxes. And you know, this, whether it's a limit or a cap, I'm sure that we'll get some emails somewhere saying it's not a cap, it's a spending limit, not a hard cap on spending. The Republican, the traditional definition of a spending cap is something that's indexed right to population growth and inflation.
The semantics police will be out in full force.
Yeah, well. I really do think it's the tax issue. For the uninitiated, the Democrats in negotiating the spending limit cap, whatever you want to call it, insisted that it be linked to taxes. So if the spending cap passes, Prop 1A passes, then all these new tax increases that were passed by the legislature a couple of weeks ago, last week, whatever it was, will stay in effect 3 years longer than if the cap is defeated. If 1A is defeated, those taxes will only be on the books for 2 years. And if 1A passes, the taxes will stay on the books for 3 more years.
Which we talked about, I think, in last podcast or the one before, I forget, that it seems counterintuitive from an average person thing. Great.
Right.
If I vote yes, I'm voting to increase my taxes for longer. If I vote no, shorter tax increase.
And that will be the campaign against a spending cap, that it's a campaign for – that it's a vote for, what, $13 billion a year in taxes, right? So it would be an extra $39 billion a year in taxes.
Well, which is the great question. Will there be a big organized campaign against the cap or against any of these? I mean, that remains to be seen. I think a lot of people – I'm sure you've talked to people, I've talked to people who are – who are the campaign pros on all sides here in Sacramento, are talking to various different interest groups and different people and watching and figuring out what to make of this. You've got some big money players who have got to make decisions about, you know, where they're going to, you know, are they going to put their chips down? Are they going to play? Are they going to make a big issue? You're going to fight, you know, are you going to fight one part of it, all of it, or not?
Right.
Or is it just the governor and I guess his allies in this, which is the Democratic leadership and
sort of
a few others, and business community in some ways, Chamber of Commerce,
small business,
or is it just going to be those folks having the megaphone, the platform to themselves?
Well, I think the last thing the governor wants to do is to start parsing these initiatives, and he's going to sell it as a package. We saw a new campaign committee formed yesterday that didn't officially have the governor's name on it, but his political team was behind it.
And he's doing an event here on Thursday, the day we're recording this,
right,
with that committee.
Right.
So, I mean, it's effectively his folks.
Right. And certainly I think the governor is the chief fundraiser for this effort. And you know, they're going to sell it all as a package. I mean, these are – the governor tried to do this in 2005 with the special election, sell all these reforms one cohesive block of policy. I think there's a better case to be made this time around that there is some cohesion to these plans and to these various initiatives than back in 2005, where you had this really kind of disparate set of initiatives that the voters rejected. You know, the no folks, I mean, we talked earlier about organized labor, who were allegedly going around threatening members with recall if they supported the spending cap. There hasn't been much mobilization of the no forces yet. There was an LA Times article earlier this week making that point. And remember, we've got a really short window here. I mean, we've got 8 weeks,
right,
before we're going to be voting on this. So.
You know, talking about organized labor and the way they're going to approach it, I mean, one of the fascinating dynamics that I think people should watch for is the different parts of the labor,
right,
side of the equation. And,
right,
and the most glaring example are the teachers, California Teachers Association, and maybe, frankly, the rest of the organized labor world. Because Prop 1B, the
right,
Prop 98, $9 billion for schools, is something that the CTA is very interested in and wants the voters to endorse and approve. So it's this money for schools. But 1B only goes into effect if 1A, the spending cap, passes.
Right.
So you can't. So the CTA and their very big checkbook can't campaign against the spending cap if they want the Prop 98 money. And you got to believe they really want the Prop 98 money.
And this is a good way for people on the Republican side of the aisle to drive that wedge between the two most powerful labor unions in the state, the Service Employees Union and the California Teachers Association. There have been fights brewing for a long time, sort of behind the scenes, between these two groups, and it'll be interesting to see if it comes to the forefront during this special election. I know folks at SEIU are not happy about this deal, and I think that CTA, you're right, I mean, they're vested in having this package pass, certainly in having Prop 1A pass. And remember, teachers have their constitutional guarantee. I mean, they have an initiative on the books that says that schools get at least 39%, public schools get at least 39% of general fund revenues. So they're locked in at a certain point. But it's the service employees who basically have their stake. Their largest stake is in the health and human services portion of the budget. That's the portion of the budget that's going to be the most vulnerable, and
it's the one that doesn't have any protections by initiative or anything. Right.
It's the one that you see getting cut most often when you're talking about budget cuts. The one the part of the budget the Republicans focus in on politically, and now, I mean, I think if the spending cap passes, it's going to have the most dramatic impact on that portion of the budget.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, just one more note on that interplay between Prop 1A, the spending cap limit, and Prop 1B, the Prop 98 money, is it's a one-way attachment.
Right.
The spending cap can pass, and the Prop 98 money can fail, and the spending cap goes into effect. But
right.
It's not. But the other way around doesn't work. You know,
right.
the 1A
is the linchpin.
Right, 1A is the linchpin. And really, it's only attached to those. I mean, I believe that the other ones aren't attached to 1A at all, the lottery, right. Borrowing, right. And the tobacco tax money and all of that. So, and of course, 1A is the thing that you have to wonder: how much attention will it get? Will there be groups that organize to support, you know, only one of the other ones? We were talking before we started about, you know, some possible movement here for someone to support a campaign to support just the lottery borrowing proposal, which also is a lottery "quote unquote" modernization proposal.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, you wonder: are subgroups going to be there campaigning for one part of it? And not the rest, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I have a hard time imagining. I mean, there was some talk before that the Teachers Association was opposed to provisions in the lottery borrowing proposal, there was a lottery borrowing proposal that was placed on the ballot as part of.
Which was going
the,
to be
last,
on the ballot.
Right. Which was from the last budget back in September, superseded by this new borrowing plan. But there was some talk that there might be some opposition to that. That hasn't materialized yet. If it does happen, and I think that the dynamics of this budget change some of that. But I think that even if they are treated as a package, if there is a no campaign, if it mobilizes against the package, I think a lot of the discussion is going to be about the issues in Proposition 1A and essentially the tax increase. I think that anyone who's trying to kill this package is going to hone in on the fact that by voting for 1A, in effect, you're voting for billions of dollars in new taxes.
Yeah. So, of course, the question would be, you know, who would come up and belly up to the bar and put their money up against these issues? And none of us really know. But I'm playing a parlor game here. I have to, full disclosure, I do not have anybody telling me this is going to happen. But the parlor game question in having coffee with different people and chatting, and maybe I'm having coffee with you right now, Anthony. Actually, I don't have any coffee.
We're having coffee together, but you're not having
I'm
coffee.
Not having any coffee. But a parlor game question is... I can think of a couple of people who've got pretty big checkbooks.
I got two
who came out against this budget deal this week, and that's two of the main candidates for the Republican nomination for governor,
right.
Meg Whitman and Steve Poizner, both at their party convention, both took whacks at this budget deal and the tax increases and everything at it. And nobody's saying they're going to open their checkbooks and write a no on the budget ballot measures campaign.
Hey.
But it's not a lot of money to them compared to how much they actually have personally.
What is a lot of money to them?
To a billionaire? I don't know.
Well, are they billionaires?
Whitman says she's a billionaire, according to her Facebook 25 random things. I'm not sure about Poizner's wealth. We'll
that one didn't make my list.
Yeah, but you're right. Not neither. I forgot I'm a billionaire on my 25 random things about me.
Give or take.
But who knows? I mean, let's talk about their opposition to this. Maybe not the whole notion of whether they put money up, because who knows? And that's parlor game stuff, as I said. But you know, that certainly appealed to the core of the Republican Party at their convention this past weekend. You know, they made their strong stance against the taxes and the budget.
Right. Well, remember, both of these candidates have a history of moderate records on on certain issues, certain things. Meg Whitman is pro-choice, as is Steve Poizner. Steve Poizner has given money to some Democratic candidates, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about all of that. But you know, remember, both of these candidates now are running in closed Republican primaries. Remember back in 2002, Richard Reardon, then the mayor of Los Angeles, was going to be the he was the next governor, right? He was being crowned the next governor of California. He was going to trounce over an unknown Bill Simon in the primary.
And beat up Gray Davis at the general.
Right. But funny thing happened on the way to the election. I mean, in a closed Republican primary, Bill Simon beat Richard Reardon. Part of that may have been because Gray Davis took out ads.
Yeah.
But it was also...
But suffice it to say, it's a conservative, moderate
right.
split in the party
And
issue.
So this is an easy way for Whitman and Poizner to earn some conservative chits when those might be lacking for both of them. So, and I think in some ways it's a game of chicken between... If one of them begins a campaign against this package, you know, is the other one then forced to act? And is this an opportunity for both of them to go on the air and introduce themselves early to some voters?
Well, and think about just in the chess game of politics, the strategy that you do get a lot of recognition by putting money up for a different cause. Look at Steve Poizner in the term limits campaign, Prop 93, where he funded it and kind of became the guy against the term limits and helped beat it back. I mean, he wasn't the only person, but he helped beat back that campaign and raised his name idea at the same time. So,
right. And yeah. Arnold Schwarzenegger had his own initiative, Prop 49, after school programs. I mean, you know, people pin Pete Wilson's survival in 1994 in large part to an initiative that was on the ballot, Proposition 187, that Wilson embraced and sort of became associated with, and that dominated his campaign.
In some
well.
Ways, you could make the argument, and again, I want to be completely careful to anybody who calls and says, you know, why are you insinuating they're going to spend money against the budget ballot measures?
I'm not yet. Because we need a good fight.
Because we need a good fight, right? We're bored reporters. We're ready now.
That's right.
But let's just make one other interesting point, which is that it's an early advance to getting your name out there. And it's also, unless the other candidate, as you said, comes up and kind of battles you for it, it's almost you come out unscathed. I mean, maybe the only people that attack you are the people trying to, you know, but you come out unscathed in terms of Republican politics.
Right. Which is, what, 36% of the state? I mean, is that enough to get you elected governor? At some point, whichever of these candidates or perhaps somebody else, whoever comes through the Republican gubernatorial primary, obviously is going to have to broaden their appeal beyond the Republican base if they have any chance or of hoping to possibly become the next governor of California. I mean,
right.
Republican Party registration is declining in the state. It's just over 35% now, and it's not growing. And it's been a rough few years for Republicans in California. And the only Republicans who have succeeded statewide have been ones who have successfully reached beyond conservative orthodoxy and beyond the party base.
Well, I would think if you're someone who has enough financial resources and you're interested in all this, you're probably going to be in the field with some polling or some surveying of the public to see how they feel about
perhaps
the budget deal and the taxes and all of it to figure out whether or not you get involved in this.
That doesn't seem like an unreasonable
it
assumption.
Doesn't. Yeah. They, you know, I can figure that out. And they don't pay me what they pay political consultants.
But they should.
So let's quickly touch on, since we've talked about the Republicans in the state Republican convention this past weekend, where I guess you could say the grand old party was a grand old unhappy party of all the party faithful who they gathered for their convention. I mean,
the grumpy old party.
Yeah, that's pretty much says it, right? They're unhappy about the budget deal. They're unhappy about the taxes. They weren't too thrilled with the governor. They considered a formal apology to Gray Davis for recalling him in 2003. there was no lack of interesting political red meat out of that.
Although at the same time, in defense of my Republican friends who, you know, the Republicans have been as good as anybody as doing the whole circular firing squad thing, right, and sort of eating their young. But, you know,
both of those metaphors have been used
first
so
firing
many times.
Squad, then they eat. Right. First they shoot, then they eat.
How many times have those been written about the California Republican Party? Anyway.
Google it and get back to me. But, you know, there was a lot of talk of censuring the members of the legislature who voted for the budget.
The Republicans, the six.
Yeah, and And in the end, I think there was a lot of venting. There was a lot of anger and a lot of venting. And but in the end, a very mild resolution that essentially has no impact was passed. It allowed – it was sort of a catharsis, but they didn't do anything extreme, you know. In the end, the Republican Party ended up passing a resolution that said they would not fund any candidate for reelection who voted for these tax increases. Now,
of which there are only one.
There's only one.
Right. Right. The other five are termed out.
And I think that the governor said it best. You know, I mean, the party's broke. You know, like, I think the party should be a lot more concerned about whether it's big fundraisers, people like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Mike Vallance, whether they're going to fund the party rather than the party funding them.
And, you know, an interesting money thing, it's just an aside, but I want to point it out because I noticed it on the campaign finance reports this week. The party transferred back $650,000 to Arnold Schwarzenegger this week. Now,
I'm sure that was his.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure, you know, the governor has been the big fundraiser for the party. I mean, so it's kind of hard to say the governor doesn't have any ability to use some of that money, but it went back to his political committee. And you know that's probably going to be used some in this budget fight. And you got to wonder about party faithful who see the party writing a check to the governor who probably got whacked over the head a few times in comments at the convention. Anyway,
that they think it's their money. Well, you know,
which it's probably money that he raised at nice dinners and things like that.
It's like Fabian Nunez.
See, there you go, bringing something out from the past. Bring that out from the ugly closet.
No, but it does. Anyway. It does raise a larger point about political parties that essentially what they've become are clearinghouses for cash. There, you go through the party to avoid the individual spending limits, and you have prolific fundraisers. Whether it be Democratic leaders, like the former speaker was a very good fundraiser. But
former Governor Gray Davis was a very good fundraiser, and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right. But if you raise the money through the party, you're not subject to the same limits as you would be if you raise it to an individual account. And so that's what the party is used for. And so, you know, there's a lot of talk about parties writing, quote unquote, refund checks to individual candidates. But, you know, The counter to that is, hey, look, it's their money. They raised it, and they should be able to keep it.
All right, so let's end the podcast with this whole discussion of government reform that happened this week. And there was a big meeting here in Sacramento of people who might be interested in a constitutional convention, of which there hasn't been a constitutional convention in, 130 years?
Yeah.
It's like 1879, I think. So 130 years.
Did you Twitter at that one, too?
I did do a little Twittering at the convention. Yes, I twitched and Twittered.
Yo, Twitter.
The Twitter is the beast that I can't kill. Once you start it, you can't stop it. But so this gathering of people talking about a constitutional convention, first of all, it was fascinating on a couple of fronts. I mean, first of all, there are a lot of people who are just mad as hell. They just think the system is broken.
They're not going to take it anymore.
There you go. Thank you to Network.
Yes.
But trying to figure out how this would work and what a convention would be called to consider just seems like a really huge task. First of all, how do you call it? I mean, the legislature has the power to call it under the Constitution. So you'd have to go to the ballot, apparently, to ask the voters two things. One, do you, the voter, want the power to call a constitutional convention? That's one ballot measure. Ballot measure two, if so, do you authorize a constitutional convention?
You can ask those questions simultaneously.
Apparently simultaneously. I think there was some discussion about that with lawyers, or maybe it, who knows. But even then, and then who are the delegates? How are the delegates picked? What is the agenda for the meeting? Is it, you know, is it broad? Is it narrow? Is it the budget? Is it, you know, we don't like people having candy in their offices in the Capitol? I mean, what's on the agenda? And
right.
And then you've got to send it to the voters in an up and down vote. I mean, it's, in other words, it's not impossible, but boy, it's a lot of steps to get there.
Well, you know, it sounds so grandiose and conjures up, you know, images of Constitution Hall and, you know, the founding of the country, right?
Right.
But it would be the largest special interest grudge match.
Well, what
in human history?
Well, yeah, exactly. How would interest groups factor into that?
I mean, you know, there would be the special interest waiting to get a piece of the Constitution, which is, you know, essentially what we have now because our Constitution is so easy to amend through the initiative process. But you know, it wouldn't be pretty and it wouldn't be clean and but what's interesting, I mean, I stopped in briefly at the discussion this week. And
you didn't see me in the back twittering.
I might have seen you.
Go ahead.
I can't remember.
You just avoided me.
There was a lot going on. You were busy. but it was a full house.
Right.
And and that this is something that clearly I think the latest budget standoff has gotten the conversation going, and it seems to be more than idle chatter. Now, whether that develops into, you know, an actual scrapping and rewriting of the state constitution is another matter, but certainly there are a lot of people who at least recognize that whatever we have now isn't working as well as they would like.
And it was interesting as the week came to an end that apparently the governor said, I love it. It's a great idea. But that wasn't the best thing about what the governor said.
Right.
So at the end of the week, and I guess we'll just end it with this, the governor, I guess, had a telephone chat with George Skelton, well-known political columnist for the LA Times.
Before he went off to do his Sylvester Stallone, Dolph Lundgren cameo.
I don't know when he's doing that.
I don't know.
We'll find out.
Greatest anyway, cast in human history.
Though. So he had a phone conversation with George Skelton, a venerable columnist with the LA Times, and said, you know, I think the Constitutional Convention idea is a great idea. But the money quote out of that column was that, you know, let's get rid of all the constitutional elected officers, effectively. Lieutenant governor, treasurer, controller, you know, those should be appointed by the governor. Those should be cabinet positions. Let's just get rid of all of those.
And I will be the president of California.
I mean, that was quite a statement. That was quite an interesting statement, and especially lieutenant governor. I think he said, let's get away with
well,
it.
And the governor gutted the lieutenant governor's
budget. He line item vetoed about 62% of Lieutenant Governor John Garamendi's budget to save money in the budget crisis this last week or something. But it was just a great quote. I mean, it was vintage Arnold Schwarzenegger. We don't need all those people.
And, you know, was that off the cuff? I mean, it could have been. The governor was in Washington this week, right? He spent a lot of time at the Republican Governors Association.
Had dinner at the White House.
Meeting at the
sat
White
next
House,
to Michelle Obama.
You know, yeah. Who was wearing sleeves, I think, that night, not at the quasi-State of the Union. Never mind.
And now the fashion critic, Anthony York.
Yes. That's another podcast.
Mm.
You know, maybe he just got a taste of what a fully developed executive cabinet would look like.
Maybe so.
Maybe.
Maybe so. Something tells me it wouldn't go anywhere with the voters, and it wouldn't go anywhere with all of those people who are elected to those offices, who like being elected to those offices by the people.
I think the governor especially would like to see the controller perhaps go away at this point.
Maybe he could just pick and choose the ones that he likes or doesn't like.
Insurance commissioner can stay.
Yeah, he can stay, maybe, you know, if he minds his manners, et cetera,
right.
et cetera.
Right.
Well, while he figures that out and we figure out what happens with the budget stuff, we'll cast off here and see if we can regroup next week and see what's happening then.
More of the same.
More of the same. You know, good times. And as Anthony transfers
it's iced coffee time.
One coffee cup into a cup of ice, we will leave it at that. You hear it in the background? Okay. Ay, ay, ay. For Anthony York at Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. See you next time.